You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintzenmeyer. My guest for episode 224 is Steve Dawson. He's based in Chicago and perhaps best known for his work with the band Dolly Varden. You are right now hearing their song Saskatchewan to Chicago from their last album For a While from 2013. That band started recording in the mid-90s, releasing six albums over almost 20 years. During the last decade of that, he was also putting out solo material after a duets album with his co-front person from Dolly Varden, Diane Christensen. He's now had six solo albums, some of the last couple fronting a band called Funeral Bonsai Wedding. We'll talk about that. We're going to focus in this interview on A Mile South of Town, a song from the new album Ghosts, then look to the Dolly Varden 2000 track The Dumbest Magnets, which is the title track of the album by that name, their third album. Then look to one of the EPs by the pre-Dolly Varden band Stump the Host. The song is Bronco Nagurski from 1989. We'll conclude by listening to another song off the new album, Oh California. Learn more about Steve at stevedawsonmusic.com and learn about this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Support the effort at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will have played a little bit of Saskatchewan to Chicago by Dolly Varden from For a While 2013 to warm people up. The shape of your career that we're going to talk about, the third song we're going to talk about is all the way back in 89, right? Is that college?
Right after college. I went to college in Boston. I moved to Chicago and started that band Stump the Host. Stump the Host was 88 to 92 or something like that.
And then Dolly Varden ran from, well, the first album is 2000, right? Or
no, 95. We did it. We self-released our first album in 95. The last record was 2013.
Okay. And were you doing solo stuff during any of that?
The first solo record was...
The duets or...
Duets. Well, yeah. Duets was 2003. Six solo records. If I'm counting the Funeral Bonsai Wedding ones as solo records.
We want to get pretty quickly to the new thing. Can you characterize where you're at with this new album, Ghosts? Before we hear this song, A Mile Out of Town, that you selected. You know, is this the Funeral Bonsai stuff that you'd done closely before this seemed a bit more orchestrated? This one, when I was initially, you know, just based on this, deciding whether to have you on, I was like, oh, I don't know, another alt country guy. But then there's so much variety throughout your catalog. I'm really glad that I dipped into it and didn't just go on
Okay, cool.
The first song of the first, you know, that even in this record, we've got quite a range.
The intention on this one was to make a record live in the studio with some of my favorite musicians. That was the primary goal of this record. And with this pedal steel guy, I always wanted to record with this guy named Brian Wilkie, that's the pedal steel guy. So that influenced the sound of the record and maybe the approach of the overall approach, that it would be more Americana than some previous records. It tends to be those are the people that buy my records and enjoy it. So I thought maybe I'd do something that leans a little more in that direction anyway, just to hopefully make people happy.
Well, A Mile Out of Town, you picked one that's buried, that's maybe more of a songwriting meal than some of the others, but is not the, it's a little dark. Do you want to briefly introduce it, or should we just let people experience it in full?
It's based on an actual memory of mine. When I was living in Idaho, I grew up in Haley, Idaho as a teenager. When I was probably about 17, I was driving home late at night. And then, you know, there's nobody around. It's pitch black. There was a guy who had hit a deer. He was on his motorcycle and he'd hit a deer and they were both laying in the middle of the road. So, you know, I approached, I could see it in my headlights. I got out. The guy was still breathing. The deer was still breathing, but they, you know, it was bad news. And I don't know what happened to them. And I don't remember what happened after that. But that memory of that image has just been stuck in my mind forever. I think probably an adult came up the other direction or came up behind me and told me to go home and that they'd deal with it. But it always stuck in my mind. And so I finally just made a song out of it, out of that image, and created a backstory. And, you know, I killed them off.
I had too many tonight again. It's been a bad week. It's been a bad year. rode too fast in the dark. Again, didn't even see the white-tailed deer. Now we're lying here in the middle of the road, in the middle of a pitch black night, breathing our last breaths together, not a sound, nobody else around for miles and miles. I was born the happy little son of an tours out of high school, serving Uncle Sam. When I need to forget, I go out and ride around. That's how I ended up in the middle of the road, in the middle of a pitch black night, face to face with the sad mama dear, staring at me, staring back at her, panic in her eyes. She doesn't want to die. Sunrise, some farmer's gonna come driving by. You see my bike in the ditch. He'll put it all together. You see us lying here in the middle of the road, still as a photograph. Skid marks and the blood and the broken mama dear. Whiskey still alive from my last breath.
So very minimalist in structure in a way, and very dark. Did you tell the drummer pretty much hardly hit the cymbals at all? Or the cymbal that he does, that he has this crash, is like a very, like all of the highs are drained out of it. Was there something special in the, or is that just in the engineering?
I love that cymbal. John Abbey, the guy who recorded it, and I discussed how to record it. So the tom-toms had a sheet over them so that they were dead. And we were all sitting very close, like within a few feet of each other. I think what happened with the cymbal is it bleeds into the vocal mic and the guitar mic, in addition to an overhead drum mic, so that it feels like it's everywhere suddenly. And it's just probably the sound of his cymbal. He has a pretty dark crash cymbal. We didn't really talk about it. I made some demos and sent them around to those guys. That was one. We did that in one take. We just sat there, did it. And we thought, that's probably about as good as that's gonna be. And that was it. Just the trio. I overdubbed almost like a dobro thing, this sort of like acoustic lap steel thing on there, just to make it a slightly more creepy.
I don't know, usually even where to put the solo or how busy the solo should be requires a little coaching, a little, not a first take.
Yeah, I know. I've played with Gerald, the drummer, Gerald Dowd and John Abbey. I've played with them quite a bit over the last 10 years or so. There's a lot of sort of just intuitive stuff. And they're both just great, great musicians. Gerald's a songwriter, a really good songwriter. So he thinks big picture. A lot of things just happen naturally that are sort of compositional. And yeah, the arrangements kind of just fall into place in a really nice way.
Was it his decision, the drummer's decision, to do this tom-heavy part? Like, is there even snare in it? Or did he just turn the snare off the snare?
The snares are off, yeah. So he's...
Okay, so it serves as one part of the tom world.
Yeah.
This string scraping thing that even is during your little solo there that he's going... But
that's the slide guitar thing that I overdubbed.
Oh, okay.
That's like the sound of the slide rubbing against the,
sure,
the strings. Yeah.
Okay. So that was, did not, again, sound like that would be a first take.
I love that sound. I put it on things probably too much. That sound of a slide just kind of vibrating on a string,
mm-hmm,
with almost no tone. It's more just a scrapey sound.
All right. So we don't have to stick Hugh as closely musically to, I don't know, this sounds more like Tom Waits or something than Americana.
Yeah. Or people have said like Nebraska era Springsteen.
Sure, sure, sure.
Which, you know, I'm a huge fan of that record, so I guess that's fine.
I guess since we were talking about the weird drum sound, the bass mixes so well with the drums on this. Like, I thought it was upright at first, but then clearly there's some electric-y sounding things. Is he doing anything special, or is this just his sound that he uses on everything?
I don't know if it's the sound he uses on everything, but it is part of his sound. John Abbey is another just great, great musician and plays to the song. Yeah, I love playing music with him. And he always makes just the best decisions. And he and Gerald play together a lot. So they really are, it feels like they're kind of two sides of the same voice a lot of the time. So a lot of that stuff, like, it was not rehearsed, it just happened. His melodic lines definitely complement the song. And he injects a little sort of like, a little extra darkness. There's some dissonant stuff going on in the bass that is maybe more sort of blues based. That might be where the Tom Waits thought comes in. It's a little more something like from a Howlin' Wolf record or something.
Any thoughts on just the way you structured, like how straight is this going to be in terms of when you're going to put in the little extra chord changes to get you the next section? Or
I think that like the breaks between verses, I think they're all the same length, but they would just wait for me to start singing. I mean, that's kind of a similar with Funeral Banzai Wedding. Each section is subdivided by some instrumental activity. And then once I start singing, it's sort of, okay, now we're back to the form. I think there's less of that in this, but there's some of that for sure. So there's just a lot of listening going on. It wasn't discussed, like I'll do 8 bars. It was just, we'll just sit on that chord until I start singing and then the form begins again.
I had too many tonight again. It's been a bad week.
Yeah, so even just having that, we're going to do that, dun, dun, that gesture, that just a cadence that just reappears. Otherwise, you could just do it, you know, pretty much one chord through quite a lot of it.
Right, right, right.
And that you're using that to conduct, okay, this is where everybody's coming in. Again, you said it wasn't discussed, but even just in the composition that, I'm going to have the guitar answer my voice or something like that. Yeah, any just thoughts about as these things evolve, like, are those just right there from the beginning? Or are you adding these as you go? Or are you simplifying, actually, you know, between the demo?
I'm allowing those musicians to interpret it how they see fit. So I had made an acoustic demo that more or less had the form. There might have been some extra more or less bars in between, but the structures of each verse were the same on the demo. So they would have listened to the demo and sort of like thought about, maybe not practiced, but thought about, okay, here's what I'll do. But it was Gerald's decision to come in on that dark cymbal crash, and John probably responded to that. It's too bad we couldn't have those guys, because they would be able to say more clearly what they were thinking. Because I was just playing the song and just thinking, oh man, that sounded good.
Well, let's go back to the composition then. You're right. So you had this memory of a particular incident Glad to hear it was not from your perspective, but hey, this happening to somebody else. But then you created this whole backstory. And even if, you know, the song as a whole might not sound super Americana, well, you got, he's in a single wide, not just a, you know, trail. We're going to call it a single wide. You got these rural sort of tropes in here in creating this character. Any thoughts in both how you created that character and how you chose to deliver that vocal as him with the pauses and the you know, sort of the bottom, near the bottom of your range? Or
that felt right based on the situation, the sort of like being late at night, and that this guy is in a situation that he knows he's not going to get out of. And so there's this just resignation. It's like, all right, this is where I am. I mean, it's a heightened situation because he knows he's going to die, but he's resigned to it, thinking back through what led to this moment. I was friends when I was in junior high with a kid whose dad was a sheep farmer who lived in a single wide. You know, I'd go hang out with him. It wasn't just from out of thin air that I came up with these ideas of who this guy was. I mean, I grew up with a number of people who could have been this guy, like people that were just, you know, veterans or burnouts or people that just life did not go the way that they had hoped.
The progression through the song, right? Because you let it open up a little bit with the chorus that it's not just all right. Okay, now we pitch up, but we're not going to ever open it up. We're not going to have a big bridge that like, and all the things I could have done, or, you know, something like that. It had to stay in that moment.
Right.
With enough, it's flashing back. You can't be purely in the moment. There wouldn't, I mean, what would you keep describing through three verses?
Exactly.
But yeah, any thought about just how much detail you were wanting to provide? Because it seems like once you get biographical, you know, this could be a 12 verse song, or
right.
It could be like, let's describe the minutiae of the dust floating around you as the your last breath is leaving you.
One good thing about songs is it forces you to be kind of minimal. I mean, I get, unless, like you said, you write a 7 verse song. But, you know, if you've got your basic 3 to 4 minute length, there's not a lot of space to get too into the weeds. So first verse, here I am. Here's where I am. Second verse, looking back. Third verse, kind of sort of future, like in the morning, we're going to get found. And that form, present moment, looking back, looking forward, you can find in a lot of songs. It's an effective form that I've used before. I don't write too many character songs, but I've always wanted to. I mean, I really respect that in people like John Prine and Patty Griffin and people that write these incredible character songs. So that was definitely a goal with this song.
Well, it opens up beyond your limited experience and your philosophy, whatever you happen to be thinking, that, you know, you can just, once you get good at writing characters, well, you could just never stop. You could.
Yeah.
So this is a rarity in your catalog. Are you finding enough as an older person who's probably not as full of angst as, you know, the 1989 song we're going to talk about?
Right.
Yeah. How are you fishing around for ideas, or has the frequency of songwriting been pretty consistent, or?
No, it's definitely tapered off. I wait for ideas now rather than being sort of flooded with ideas or feeling this need to like express myself. Mm-hmm. So it is an interesting place to be. Maybe I will write more character songs. I've been writing a few things that I kind of like, but you're absolutely right. As you get older, I think you get more reflective and less angsty.
Well, let's turn the clock back a little, get a second song out there. The title track from The Dumbest Magnets You Picked by Dolly Varden. This is 2000, or is this the first, this is the 1995 album?
Well, this song goes back to like 98.
Okay.
Dolly Varden recorded it for the record that came out before that called The Thrill of Gravity, but we didn't like it. So we kept it and then did a new version of it when we went down to Nashville to record with this guy named Brad Jones, this producer, for The Dumbest Magnets. So it came out in 2000, but a version of the song had been kicking around for a couple of years.
Okay, so on the Bandcamp page for this album, I see there is a demo version that I listened to a little. So that's the actual previous Dolly Varden recording.
Yeah.
Any thoughts about where you were at stylistically? There's strings in this song. It's a little more filled out. You sort of turned over. I heard in the initial demo, you kind of played the main riff yourself. There's a whole different intro where you're playing it on acoustic.
Right.
It seems like you've passed it to the electric player to take with the strings, not even at the beginning of the song, but as a periodic theme that comes back.
It started out with that riff. I remember standing in our kitchen and just playing that riff on the guitar and loving it. It has those half steps. So it's got sort of like a sweet dissonance to it that I really like.
Well, let me then play from that demo version, because the riff starts the song, just the intro of that.
And that's an unusual way for me to write, to come up with a riff. I'm not a riff writer as much as words and melody. So I had that, and then I started thinking about, it's about my relationship with my wife, Diane. And at that point, we would have been married for like 8 years. And so there's reflection on the wedding itself, and there's reflection on, so it's really impressionistic. I mean, I think I've been hinting at this type of writing, but I think this is one of the first ones that really worked. Actually, there's quite a few songs on this, on that record, The Dumbest Magnets by Dolly Varden, where it's groups of images that hint at a narrative but aren't overt. And I think I've been trying to do that, but that this is the first time that it actually was working. And I'll say, like, someone like Phoebe Bridgers is like a genius at this. I love her, but I also am like, man, how could she figure this out at 25 years old or whatever? But whatever. It took me longer to figure it out. But this song is a collection of images around my relationship with Diane and around our actual marriage. So the high notes, we had this woman that was, we had a spiritual choir. I was working with this woman who was in a spiritual choir, and they were the music during the wedding ceremony, and they had this woman sing who was a soprano who's had this just stunning voice, and that her voice just going up through into the ceiling of this building where we were in. And it's just like this thought of those notes still hovering up in there was a good thought and a good image that stuck in there. And then The Dumbest Magnets, I don't know, I have mixed feelings about that image, but it was just that, like, if these two pieces of metal can figure out a way to stick together, then we certainly can.
Your nervous laughter is contagious. My will has broken down in stages. We scraped the bottom of the block. Together.
Yeah, the way this starts, I mean, this almost sounded more like a Posies tune or something to me.
Yeah, that was probably Brad Jones. Brad is a really good producer and a great musician. And I'll bet, and I don't remember, but I'll bet that it was his idea for me to just, just start strumming and singing and have the band peel in.
And like the last song, you have another Nervous Laughter is Contagious, dun, 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 like that the guitar answers you. I mean, is that just part of your style of, here's what I sing while playing? I don't want to do changes necessarily while I'm singing. I'm going to have it answer. I don't know.
Probably, yeah. I just did a thing recently with some other songwriters and someone pointed out some melodic thing that is a new song. And he's like, oh, that sounds like something that you would do. It's like, oh, okay, great. But I'm not aware of that.
So again, we're starting. Is this the way the previous song that we had acoustic? You had the little part with you by yourself with your acoustic, and then everybody comes out before the first verse is even over. So it's not like you're saving them for the chorus or something. And here it's quite a bigger production when they finally come in, and that you have the background vocal come in on that together and then stay on the whole line. It's not like she's doing together and forever. Do you have any thought? Because you didn't do it quite that way on the demo, I remember. There was more harmony throughout.
Yeah. Again, it's a long enough ago that I don't remember the specifics of who made that decision. But my guess would be that would be Diane's intuition. Diane is a great harmony singer and a great musician. And then she might have made that decision of when to come in and when to stay in and then when to drop out, with probably Brad's coaching.
So yes, as someone also in my current band, I have a female singer, but I'm the main songwriter. And I, so there's a little, it's all very goodwill. But yeah, any thoughts about your experience in Dolly Varden, that you're going to add a second singer who's going to sing some, did she write some stuff by herself or were you writing for her? Or so it was just two singer-songwriters, but yet you got to be the 70% guy or something like that? Or what was the politics of that band?
There was a period where Diane was writing quite a bit. That was around Dumbest Magnets and the record that came after it, where she wrote the most songs. So it's kind of all of the above. Like, I wrote songs for her to sing. There's one on there called The Thing You Love Is Killing You. And that one I wrote for her to sing.
Having that freedom of, I can expand beyond my actual voice. I can write from a different point of view.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's fantastic to have that option. Sort of like the Robbie Robertson. I mean, that is the ultimate version of like him writing those songs and then saying like, let's have Richard Manuel sing this one. Or maybe we'll have Levon sing this one. It's like, what a dream come true to have three incredible voices to cast your songs against. But in terms of like, I've always been more prolific with songs. Diane's main thing is she's a painter. She's an artist. And that's been her primary passion. But she's also a really gifted harmony singer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be writing six songs to her every one song. So it was never a kind of thing where she was going to have as many songs on a record as me.
Was this band a strictly, you're the acoustic guy, and then the fancy player comes and does the solos and sort of can take the lion's share of the space?
Yeah, especially at this point.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, yeah, Mark Belletto was the electric guitar color guy. I was the acoustic guitar singer, Diane harmony singer.
With this band, I mean, it sounds like with the last thing, the live thing, you were like, I'm not going to tell you guys what to do. I trust you guys. What was it like? Were you more of a control freak at this point?
I've never been a control freak. I like to let people play what they're going to play within reason. Like if something's like really, if I feel like it's really contrary to the song, I'll say like, maybe try something else. But I would never tell someone like, oh, this note, this note, this note. Unless it's a specific part that's part of the composition, like here's the riff.
Yeah.
But in terms of solos or like embellishments or colors, I really leave that up to the musicians. I will say though, Brad Jones got pretty into the weeds with everybody. Like, and he's primarily a bass player, but he's an incredible musician. But I remember him sitting with Mike, the bass player, and just going note by note through some of his parts, which Mike took it pretty well, but that had to be hard. And he did that on some of Mark Belletto, the guitar player's stuff. But Mark comes up with really beautiful melodic parts. And his solo on this particular song is just beautiful. It's gritty and the tone is really, it's really good. I love it.
Yeah, that you've got him playing that riff again, the diddly-doo-doo-doo, but then it sort of goes straight into this, okay, the strings are not following him anymore. He's just doing this loud chordal thing.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it's mixed so high. Like, it really takes over the space.
I'm glad it is. It gives it, it keeps it from being too sweet, I think. Although, I mean, you know, that's subjective. I'm sure some people think it's...
Well, the harmonies make it very, very sweet, all this together and forever. And I can, you know, now that you say like, oh, this is about a wedding and it's okay, I can see that. And in terms of when the harmonies come in, is this being in a band with a male and a female singer, is there any of the like, I'm writing a little play and it's, oh, this is the couple singing together, or is it just purely sonic rather than theatrical?
To me, it's sonic. I don't think theatrics as much as I probably should to get things across. Like for me, I would be like, yeah, let's Graham and Emmylou this thing to everything. You know, let's just sing it in two-part harmony. Diane's like, I'm sick of that. Country two-part harmony. As much as, I mean, that's how we started singing together, singing country songs, and we're very good at that. It's sort of in our bones. But I think she's someone who wants to push and try new things and get sick of things probably more than I do.
There are more questions than answers.
Just that we've had this flurry before, and now we're going to... It sounds like the song has ended completely.
Yeah.
I don't think the demo does that. Like, it might have some of these parts, and it has you doing this falsetto thing to kind of take... So it has the outro in there, but it doesn't have this whole, after less than 3 minutes, oh, the song's done. Oh, you faked you out. Here's a long outro. With it being three part, in fact, with that building vocal, that is beautiful, which I assume it's, did you have a third person on stage to do the high part? Or is this just a recording only?
And when we do it live, it's just two. We don't add the third, yeah.
Well, so does she jump up to the highest one, or are you just...
She does.
Okay, all right. So it's covered.
Yeah.
So any thoughts about that arrangement decision, if you even recall at this time?
I recall the Mellotron strings was my idea. And I think Brad might have been like, I don't know. But then once we found it, the sound and the parts, it was like, okay, that sounds really good.
Yeah. Once that big outro is in force and the third harmony has come on, it almost sounds like you have the drums have timpani, or maybe he's just doing his low tom or something to that it really makes it sound orchestral.
It's with the tom-tom, but he mic'd it from across the room, so it had that big, you know, so it had that big sound. So very orchestral. This song was really embraced by this guy on BBC Radio 2, this guy named Bob Harris, who's this kind of legendary music presenter. He was the host of the Old Grey Whistle Test, if you've ever seen those clips from...
Oh, yeah.
So this guy, Bob Harris, fell in love with this song. And basically, this song alone was the reason that we got a record deal over there, and we toured over there for like 10 years, and have a bunch of UK fans just based on Bob Harris falling in love with this one song, which is crazy.
Yeah, so say something about the shape of this band. So this was the second album, right? Or the third album, this one?
This was, so we self-released Mouthful of Lies, and then the first one on a label was The Thrill of Gravity, and then this was the third record.
All right, and then the rest of that. So I don't think I heard anything before here. I heard the ones on Spotify and then went to this. So what was the life cycle of this? It was just everybody having kids and the normal, like, why bands don't tour anymore, or was there...
Kind of, yeah. So this would be the peak of 2000, 2001 would be the peak of, we were touring the US, we were touring the UK, getting really good reviews, actually selling records and getting airplay. 2002, both members of the rhythm section, you know, became fathers. And I think that's, you know, after 9/11, there was this kind of resetting and nesting that happened. And kind of like this, like, I don't know. We did do a tour of the UK in late September 2001. That was pretty, pretty stressful, really stressful. Yeah, so they had kids and we stopped touring. And Diane and I did that duets record sort of as a way to continue touring. And that was 2003. Then I made my own solo record. That was my first solo record, Sweet as the Anchor, around 2004, 2005. And then Dolly Varden sort of was like, let's make another record. So we got ourselves together and made one called The Panic Bell. And that came out in maybe 2006, something like that. And then it was a back and forth between a Dolly Varden record and me doing a solo record for a little while, up through 2013. The last Dolly Varden record was 2013. And since then, and then I did Funeral Bonsai Wedding, and then I've just been doing a bunch of stuff to kind of like entertain myself.
So was the Funeral Bonsai Wedding project, was that some Dolly Varden people?
Funeral Bonsai Wedding is me and then these guys that I worked at a record store all the while this was all going on. That was a jazz and blues record store, the Jazz Record Mart in Chicago. It was pretty famous. And the owner was a guy that owned Del Mar Records. And the staff were pretty much all jazz musicians or experimental or free jazz guys or just kind of like weirdo experimental music people. And I loved them and I would go see them play and just sort of fell in love with that whole freedom and like what they were doing. So I approached them as I was working with them too and said, would you ever consider playing music with me, like me doing my whatever it is I do, my singer-songwriter thing, and you doing what you do? And they were like, yeah, let's do it. So that's what Funeral Bonsai Wedding was. So it was me. It was this guy named Jason Adashevitz, who plays vibraphone, Jason Rebke, who plays upright bass, and Frank Rosalie, who's just a genius drummer percussionist.
Yeah, that's unusual to have so much vibraphone on it. Usually that's a, like, okay, we got somebody to do a song or fill in a part. But
he is a force of nature, that guy. It's playing music with him is, it's just like holding a live wire or something. It's so inspiring and so fun and so just elevated. He's a one of a kind, that guy.
So I will link folks from the blog post associated with this episode to a Funeral Bonsai song or two, or folks can look that up. But I said, I want an old one. So we got all the way back to a Stump the Host song. So this was a Bronco Nagurski. Was this a single from 1989, or was this part of an unreleased album, or was this released, or what is the status of this?
At that point, I mean, in 89, we were making recordings and selling them on cassette tapes at our shows. So, I mean,
it counts.
Self-releasing a cassette.
If you never really got beyond that, then it counts. Let me put it that way. So for you.
We made two cassette releases, and Bronco Nagurski was basically two cassette EPs. So Bronco was on the first Stump the Host cassette.
Okay. Any thoughts about it before we hear it, other than we'll warn people that the recording quality is not quite as good?
It's 80s production. There was a guy who recorded all the live broadcasts for WXRT here in town, the big FM radio station here in town. And he was a really great guy, and he would just pull his truck up into an airplane hangar, and you'd set up, and he would record you as if it was a live broadcast. And he did a great job, but it was all done very quickly, all live. And that's how we made those things, because it was affordable. So we could do it, and you know, we'd go out there and do it all in one evening. So Bronco, the reason I picked it is because I think it's one of the first songs that shows signs of what I'm still doing.
Okay.
Which is image heavy, classic song form, a little sideways, a little hard to understand what's happening, but that there is an overreaching narrative. There's just something, maybe there's some intangibles that I'm not clearly stating that to me seem like a through line to what I'm still doing. Whereas a lot of that early stuff is just like I listen to and go like, oh my God, that was just horrid. You know, what was I doing? But this one, I'm like, oh, that's not that bad. And it does make sense that I wrote it.
Is it the kind of thing you would ever revive and put in the live set?
Yeah, maybe. I might. I'm not embarrassed by this one. I'm embarrassed by my singing from then. I mean, I think I've gotten to be a much better singer, but the song itself, I think, is good. It's funny that there's this like instrumental bridge that goes off into this kind of Middle Eastern thing, which is hilarious to me. And I loved it at the time. But I remember even the other guitar player at the time going like, that doesn't make any sense to this song. And I'm like, yeah, but it sounds cool. Because Bronco Nagurski was a Polish American Chicago Bear, a football player. When I was a little kid, I was a football fan. And he was one of those like leather helmeted 1930s football guys that the story was he could, you know, run through a brick wall, which is, you know, whatever. And it just felt like at that time in my life, life felt like I was trying to run through a brick wall. That was the overriding metaphor of that song.
Bronco was a professional man who could slam his head through a brick wall and come smiling out the other side in 1935. I can't relive the moments carefully, but I can't be sure. I went wrong while you repainted the ceiling. I hummed along with the swan, silver tones. But I'm not gonna open my mouth. Well, I'm not gonna open my mouth, 'cause there are certain secrets that you should never tell. Comes from dirt, that's why we both are so unhealthy. And then we exchanged that look of loss, but there was still something you had to tell me. With my feet on the rug, my head in your sand, my arms wrapped around the shoulders. Opened up like a book of my test, but I was gasoline instead of water. But I'm not gonna open my mouth. Well, I'm not gonna open my mouth, 'cause there are certain secrets that you should never tell. Sorry that it hurts to remind me. I've covered it up with gestures and laughs, but I can feel it creeping from behind me. But I'm not gonna open my mouth. Well, I'm not gonna.
We again have this acoustic guitar driven intro with this sort of offbeat thing, which is going to recur throughout the chorus. Do you even remember at this point where this riff would live in your corpus of the time? Were you just constantly coming up with guitar riffs, or was this a particularly...
It's pretty straightforward. It's just a simple bass string walk, and it has that do-do-doom down to the minor thing.
It's really just the offbeatness that makes it unique, because other if it was just da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da...
Right. I remember being happy with it. In terms of, at that point, I was still pretty young and wanting to impress, or maybe not impress, but get the approval of the other guys in the band. The people in the band were older than me and were more experienced musicians. And so I'd be a little shy about sharing songs, but it was my band. They were all my songs. And I remember just, they were all like, yeah, that's cool. That's a really cool riff. So I remember being happy with that.
And you get this turnaround. Is it an actual augmented chord, or is it just this that goes like into the choruses?
It's probably just a dominant seventh chord. I don't think it's an augmented chord.
Sure.
Tim really liked the reverb. And I remember we fought with him a lot about the amount of reverb. But he was like, what, do you want it to sound like the 70s? And we're like, yeah, kind of.
All right, let me get us into the chorus here then. So actually, before that, it just does it's the end of the chorus that I'm thinking about. But just the fact that you actually settle back to the tonic, da-da-da-da-da-da, and now we're going to do the chorus. Yeah, as opposed to getting out of the chorus, which... Yeah, okay, so there's that dominant that just gets us back into the riff.
To get us back into the minor. So the verses are in minor and the chorus is in major.
We still have many secrets that you got the rhythm from the intro in there. Do you remember at this point which came first? It was probably the intro that came first rather than the actual chorus.
Probably, yes, probably.
Yeah, any thoughts about just the way you do the narrative on this? You got the Bronco stuff just in the first verse, and the rest of it is, well, sort of ambiguous, impressionistic, but definitely personal about your relationships. Do you even remember what this song is otherwise about? What the secrets are that you can at last tell.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't know. The 20-something-year-old angsty mind about, I could never tell you about my real pain kind of thing.
Okay. So it's not that it's secret. It's that it's inexpressible because it is you so unique.
Or something. I don't know if I could. I'd have to like astral project back into my own self when I was that age. I remember thinking it was cool, and it was a cool line. There's certain secrets you should never tell, and not even maybe then not knowing exactly what that meant, but that it meant something. It felt right.
That's what songwriting is. I know it means something. I don't have to know exactly. That's why we have a song.
Yeah.
So sorry that it hurts to remind me. I've covered it up with gestures and laughs, but I can feel it creeping from behind me. But I'm not gonna open my mouth. Well,
yeah, okay, so there we actually don't resolve to the tonic again. We have this creepy part where everybody's chick, chick, chicking and crescendoing. Like, how much were you playing this live before you recorded it, do you recall? Or was
That's an excellent question. Probably quite a bit, actually. Mm-hmm. We had those songs down.
So you had the dramatic moments, the fact that was going to be the moment, you know.
Yeah, and as I'm listening, so I'm remembering that this was the result of me listening to Elvis Costello, Blood and Chocolate nonstop around that time and just being obsessed with wanting to get that just like crunchy, angsty, whatever's going on that record where he's at his wit's end and the band is right there with him.
Yeah, vocally. So around in the early 90s, I really loved Elvis Costello and was trying to sing sort of too forcefully for really what I should be doing and using too much vibrato. I'm hearing more like Bodine's or Chris Isaak or maybe even trying Roy Orbison, something a little more rounded than you do this these days. Was this just for this song, since I haven't heard the other things from this era?
No, I was trying to figure out my voice. I was just trying to figure it out.
And how to cut through the band that in later, when you're more confident and the sound is better, you can say, look, I'm going to sing delicately, stay out of the way, as opposed to here where like the guitars are chunky and unless you're blasting through and you don't have a really, you don't have a Geddy Lee voice or something that's going to pierce right through.
Totally. My natural singing voice leans towards very pretty, like John Denver or James Taylor, Jackson Browne, like real pretty, sort of sweet, gentle. I think at that point I was trying to be tougher. I was trying to sound tougher by like being more, like maybe a little more, like you said, rounded. But like I've learned to sort of like just find my voice. And also I think as I've aged, it's gotten a little grittier. So it lends it. It naturally has some of the sound that I didn't have when I was in my 20s that I was trying to like, you know.
So like the yelling part here, is there a mature version of that you actually do feel like you can deliver on? Or do you just not do that? Because I didn't notice that on too many of your songs in the new album. You know, I can't offhand.
Yeah, I could sing this song really well now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I could do it justice now, I think.
I've had recent albums where I'm like, let me re-record something from 1992 and make it sound the way it should have sounded before. And actually, it sounds pretty continuous. Maybe I have to fix the lyrics a little bit, but
yeah,
it seems like this one would be a good candidate for that. Or do you just have so many new ideas that there's no reason for you to revisit old things?
No, I don't have so many new ideas, but there's some thought of like, well, that's going backwards. So like going back and sifting through really old songs doesn't feel like the right thing to do creatively. But I will say on the new record, there is a song that is from around this same time. It's a little later, early 90s, called When I Finally Let You Down. That song goes back to Stump the Host that I pulled back because that one never got a proper recording or release. And in fact, we just played a show this last weekend and played that song. And someone said, how long have you been sitting on that song? I was like, well, what's that? Almost 30 years. And he's like, that's ridiculous because that's a really good song. So,
and are the lyrics recognizably like, I would not write like this now, but this is the time capsule that I'm just going to present it like it is? Or do you like rethink them and tweak them or make them less embarrassing?
It's pretty good. It's a character song about someone who's really in a really bad place, but it feels truthful. I mean, I grew up with alcoholics in my family, so it's not, the guy in the song is an alcoholic and is sort of like wrecking everything around him. So it's not like I was, again, like the guy in the motorcycle song. It's from observation of real things that I create that character. So the character in When I Finally Let You Down is someone I'm familiar with, but it's definitely not me.
So you've got the country cred from your upbringing. You're not just some Chicago suburban guy who decided at some point, I don't know, you were saying that things were, the people who like your music now are into this alt country thing. And so like, oh, I might as well serve them. And I find as I'm playing acoustic, it gravitates, you know, if I'm not trying to do like XTC or some like purposefully skewed thing,
right,
then like there's going to be some twang on some, so there's going to be something that is gravitating toward that area. But for me, I don't know, it's been a long, slow thing because I got into country by listening to people making fun of country, by listening to Don't Pass Me By, Don't Make Me Cry, Don't Make Me Blue. The Beatles and the Stones, when the Stones would do country, or Camper Van Beethoven, or what, you know, what was your background in terms of that musical style? Like, was that part of just what you loved, Johnny Cash or whatever, from the beginning? Or is this something that you acquired as you were?
Well, as a little kid, I just loved the radio and I loved pop music. Mm-hmm. I loved the Beatles, you know, whatever was on the radio in the 70s, I loved. So I didn't know country music didn't make an appearance in my life except for like heat when Hee Haw was on. But I thought Hee Haw was cool, actually. I remember loving the music. And then when we moved to Idaho, there was country music everywhere and the only radio station was country.
So by saying I loved what was on the radio, but then only mentioning the Beatles, who are cool, you're neglect. So you're into like Bread and Air Supply and all the terrible 70s stuff. That is, or did you, were you even?
I was talking more like Elton John and Stevie Wonder was on the radio.
How much Stevie Wonder it gets into your present style? Do you find,
I mean,
like,
I love it so much.
There's vocal inflections and soul things.
There's definitely an R&B influence in some of the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I love, that's the other music I love the most is 60s and 70s soul and R&B stuff. That's my other sort of main favorite. That stuff I didn't come to till I was at the end of high school and in college. But I think so when we moved to Idaho, I guess the radio, and then my dad was into Willie Nelson, and my dad was way into Emmylou Harris, Merle Haggard. And then I started, because of maybe Dylan talking about Hank Williams, maybe reading about what people loved, I got into Hank Williams hard and learned like all those songs and just did a deep dive into country music in high school, like late high school and college, and got into George Jones and Buck Owens, Loretta Lynn, Patsy Cline, all that stuff. And then when I moved to Chicago, they were actually, all those people were still touring, and they would come up through, there's a venue down in, just over the border in Indiana, in Merrillville, Indiana, that used to get all, like George Jones, Merle Haggard, all those people. And we used to go, I used to see him. So I saw all the greats in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And it was fantastic.
That's the formative years. That's the authentic, you know, if I can say.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the stuff that you didn't choose before that, which my dad was into John Denver. Like that was my starting point of that kind of melodicism. And then like, how can I make something cool out of that basis?
Yeah. Well, at the same time, yeah. So when I got a guitar in seventh grade, all the relatives sent me books by like James Taylor, Neil Young, Paul Simon, Jackson Browne. And that's, I learned to play guitar playing those songs, John Denver, all those songs. That's a big part of, yeah, just like, because it's embedded in my DNA now. It's like how you do this on an A chord, because that's what James Taylor does, you know, that sort of stuff.
Well, I think it's fitting then that we wrap up here by introducing California, the most well-liked song, as Spotify would tell us, from the new album. And maybe more typical of, it is not as dark in Tom Waits' ears, whatever is the one we talked about. Catchy as all heck. And I would recommend to folks like this that they, you know, work their way back through your catalog, because there's so many other things that shine brightly like this one. Any thoughts to set us on our way as folks are about to hear California?
Well, this one features a woman named Nora O'Connor on harmony vocals. Like one goal of this record was to play with all these people, all these Chicago musicians that I admire. And so I asked Nora to sing on this, and it has Brian Wilkie really featured on the pedal steel on this. And then Gerald plays some beautiful drum parts on it. So it's collaborative with some of my favorite Chicago musicians.
All right. Well, strongly recommend the new album, Ghosts. Thanks so much for chatting.
Yeah, thank you.
Sets an easy mark.
a beautiful tune that's called Oh California, not just California. You can learn about this and other Steve Dawson stuff at stevedawsonmusic.com. It's a little confusing because there are multiple Steve Dawsons if you search on YouTube, if you search on Spotify. I see there is a wiki page, Steve Dawson, parentheses, American musician, if you want to be really clear on which ones are actually him. This includes all of his Dolly Varden stuff. You can look for dollyvarden.bandcamp.com to hear all those albums. And as promised in the show notes for this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, I have linked to a full Funeral Banzai Wedding album, the first of his two collaborations with that band. And I've linked to an official video for that song, Oh California. I've linked to the full recording of our intro music, Saskatchewan to Chicago, some live footage, the stuff I usually do. If you check out the posts at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, or better yet, patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, where you will also get a link to my show notes with the lyrics and the song structured laid right out there, and your experience will be entirely ad-free. That subscription, you could pledge as little as $1 per episode and max it out for the month, so it's really $1 for the month even. Of course, I'd love if you would pledge more, but even that slight effort will vastly improve your experience listening to this podcast, I think, as well as showing me that you are actually listening and want this to continue. It has again been almost a month, certainly over 3 weeks since the last episode came out. I'm going to blame my editor again because I have been continuing to move ahead interviewing some great musicians. Loudon Wainwright III is coming up, and then Ian Matthews. Both are very experienced folky sorts with albums going back to the late 60s. And for both of those guests, I read their autobiography. It seems I have autobiographies for many of my guests these days. And I might as well give you the personal update. My one-time 8-piece band that you can hear the demo from last spring at marklint.bandcamp.com is now down to 3 pieces. So I am really eager to record this new batch of songs, but will probably be playing not only the acoustic guitars, but also the basses myself, and probably the drums myself. We'll see. But the upside of a lack of a coherent local band is that I will be able to perhaps dip into my bunch of contacts that I have through this podcast and get some people to record lead guitar parts, harmony, vocals, other things from a distance. Try to get a couple of those semi-famous names on there to help the thing sell. And I will shut up about that until I actually start the recording process. Wish me luck. You can reach out to me at mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com to let me know what you think of the show, suggest some guests, suggest yourself as a guest. I would greatly appreciate if you could leave a nice rating and review for the show at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this. You should definitely support the artists, not just by listening on Spotify, but actually go purchase an album of theirs, purchase some of the songs that you're hearing on this podcast. They too really appreciate the recognition. I hope you're doing well, being creative. Keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.
Well, my great grandfather left Saskatchewan for California.